You all hear me clearly? Is that good? In the back? Good. Okay. When people I've met just hear that I'm a philosophy professor who writes on Wittgenstein, they often politely ask me whether I work on the early or the later Wittgenstein, much as one might ask someone who says she comes from Cambridge whether she lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Cambridge, England. The questions presuppose that the two are different, so that the shared name is misleading. But it's as unlikely that anyone would be equally interested in both philosophers as that someone would choose to live in both places. For this reason, saying both doesn't really do the job, because it leaves undisturbed the assumption that anyone who did work on both Wittgensteins would be much like a person with homes in two different countries. When I was writing my book on the development of Wittgenstein's philosophy, I would sometimes say that I was working on the middle Wittgenstein, and I even, for my sins, published a piece in Synthase under that title. Now, the reply was meant as a challenge to the two Wittgensteins' presumption, but it could easily give the impression that I thought the only thing wrong with it was there are actually three or more Wittgensteins, and that I wanted to replace the idea there was a sharp break between the early and the later Wittgenstein, the early or the later Wittgenstein, and the idea that there were two sharp breaks in his intellectual biography, marking the beginning and end of the so-called middle period. Now, of course, there have always been those who dissent from the view that Wittgenstein's philosophy is marked by a sharp break or turn between the early and the late. However, it is remarkably difficult to give a unitary reading of the continuities in Wittgenstein's philosophy that transcends the framework of the two Wittgensteins' debate. From the 1950s to the 1970s, so-called one Wittgenstein interpreters made the later philosophy look much like a reworking of the early philosophy, as it's usually understood on the two Wittgensteins' view. There's an extreme example of this approach in the early Feyerabend and a more moderate one in Kenner's book from the early 70s. More recently, Diamond and Conant have outlined a one Wittgenstein interpretation which effectively reverses this approach, arguing the methods of the early philosophy anticipate and prefigure the later. With the publication of the new Wittgenstein and a flurry of papers responding to this interpretation, see for instance the Kirchberg proceedings for this year, the approach has created a heated controversy, regarded by partisans on either side as nothing less than a revolution that aims to end the ancien régime of the early and the later Wittgensteins. Now, the standard account, the one that's usually taken for granted by those who've learnt about Wittgenstein from hearsay, encyclopedia articles, histories of philosophy, or even a thorough acquaintance with the secondary literature, is in terms of Wittgenstein I, the author of the Tractatus, and Wittgenstein II, the author of the Philosophical Investigations. Am I doing anything wrong here in terms of this noise?
No, we've had this problem yesterday.
Okay. There is one possibility. We could see if turning this off has any effect.
No, it's not.
How's that? Is that any better?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, I can throw my voice or I can shout at the microphone.
It was something else that was done at the same.
Okay. You'd like me to... Okay. All right. All sorts of possibilities are available, but not failing to use the microphone. Okay. So, usually the early Wittgenstein is seen as part of the development of early analytic philosophy, taking his main ideas from Frege and Russell, inspiring the work of the Vienna Circle, and thus part of the analytic mainstream, while the so-called later Wittgenstein is regarded as a marginal figure, important for historical understanding perhaps, but thanks to the rise of functionalism and scientific nationalism, no longer directly relevant to cutting-edge debates. You'll recognize this from Lars Herzberg's story. Now, this is not just the view of those who agree with Russell that Wittgenstein's later work was a retrograde step, a betrayal of the standards of argument, once one of the proudest achievements of the analytic tradition. Wittgenstein is far enough away from the present to be of little interest to most of those doing contemporary philosophy, and not yet distant enough to be part of the history for most of those same people. Most professional philosophers in the US and many philosophy departments are not interested in Wittgenstein at all. Most Wittgensteinians accept the two Wittgenstein story, while reversing the standard valuation of later and earlier Wittgenstein, maintaining the later Wittgenstein's work amounts to a philosophical revolution not accepted or even understood by their benighted colleagues. Now, two institutional yardsticks will have to do duty for a more detailed discussion of the rather low status of Wittgenstein's studies and the institutional entrenchment of the two Wittgensteins' reading. First, undergraduates with an interest in Wittgenstein who are applying for graduate programs in the States, and graduate programs, and graduate students thinking of writing a dissertation on Wittgenstein are routinely advised to highlight a complementary area of specialization and to underplay or even conceal their work on Wittgenstein. Those who do go on to write dissertations on Wittgenstein will look in vain at the American jobs for philosophers for positions asking for any kind of expertise in this area. Second yardstick. So few papers on the later Wittgenstein are accepted by the American Philosophical Association for their 3 annual meetings that recently a North American Wittgenstein Society was established with the aims of, I quote, providing means for philosophical thought and work in the broad Wittgensteinian tradition, exemplified in the investigations, and to facilitate the reading of papers on the later Wittgenstein at those meetings. The Society's statement of purpose makes it clear that as far as the founders are concerned, the interests of the Society are directed at the late Wittgenstein and his philosophical progeny. I quote, the area to be covered is not merely the later Wittgenstein, but also those significant philosophers who arose in connection with his later thought, e.g. Austin, Ryle, Strawson, Bousman, Cavell, Searle. While some of the sponsored work will be expository and exegetical, the Society especially encourages original philosophical thought in the manner of ordinary language philosophy. You can find all this on their website if you want to see it. Cora Diamond's response to the statement of this purpose turns on the way that, as she puts it, they take the two Wittgenstein's view for granted. I quote, I do object, however, to the introduction of what seems to me a particular reading of Wittgenstein into the very statement of the aims of this society. You say it is a sign of our intellectual times that Wittgenstein's later work is not a major factor in current philosophical practice. You seem to be taking for granted that nothing much is to be gained in understanding Wittgenstein by taking him to be, in the words of Peter Winch and Steve Gerrard, one philosopher, not a pair of philosophers early and later Wittgenstein. My own view, still quoting Diamond here, for what it is worth, is that the presumption interferes with our capacity to learn from the investigations and other works of Wittgenstein's later years. I think it is rather a pity having the two Wittgenstein view virtually written into the statement of the aims of the Society. Now, the Society response, still on the website, denies that they are committed to the two Wittgenstein's view. Quote, the statement of aims clearly specifies the Society as encouraging philosophical work about the body of thought almost universally referred to as that of the later Wittgenstein, as well as encouraging philosophically original work in that spirit. The aim equally certainly is not to have them sponsor work about the earlier Wittgenstein, say the Tractatus and its surroundings. Still quoting, Professor Diamond believes such a statement of aims puts the Society in the position of officially subscribing to a certain interpretation, namely the two Wittgensteins' view. That view is that the Tractatus and the investigations are so radically different, they might as well have been written by two different philosophers. The aims as written, however, did not grow out of such a view, but stating them in that fashion is based on a purely practical consideration, end quote. But the practical considerations turn on pointing out that the two Wittgenstein's view is so well entrenched in the profession that Wittgenstein I scholarship is dominated by opponents of Wittgenstein II, while those who work on or inspired by the second Wittgenstein have become so marginal in the philosophical profession that they require a certain kind of affirmative action. I quote, it is my own hope that the current statement of aims commits the Society to a kind of affirmative action program. The Society is intended to open opportunities which will rectify a wrong. When the wrong has vanished, the program, namely the aims, will disappear, become unnecessary. Well, it would be hard to imagine better evidence of how well-entrenched the two Wittgenstein's regime has become. Now, before going further into a discussion of these developments and disagreements, I must say I find this whole debate very unsatisfying. For it's nearly always presupposed here that either there was one Wittgenstein, in essentials, Wittgenstein's philosophy never really changed, or there were two, that there was a fundamental change. Very few people seem prepared to consider the possibility that these are restrictive alternatives, and the best interpretation might be one that recognizes both continuities and discontinuities in Wittgenstein's development, especially when one considers that most of those involved in these debates are not only well aware of Wittgenstein's criticism of essentialist accounts of concepts and names in the opening sections of the investigations, but profess sympathy for that critique. It's odd they're so committed to the view there must have been either one or two Wittgensteins. Why should we have to argue over whether there is something in common to all that we call Wittgenstein's philosophy, early, late, all of it? I think we'd be better off saying his writings, and here I quote Investigation 65, are related to one another in many different ways. And turning to a more worthwhile task, investigating those relations in more detail. Talk of Wittgenstein 1, Wittgenstein 2, early, late, new, later, latest, calls for just the kind of criticism Wittgenstein gives in the Blue Book of metaphysicians who introduce new uses of words. I quote, making a use different from that which our ordinary language makes of the words, which just then, for some reason, strongly recommends itself to us. And here I quote from the Blue Book, when something seems queer about the grammar of our words, it is because we are alternately tempted to use a word in several different ways. We could answer, what you want is only a new notation, and by new notation, no facts of geography are changed. It is true, however, that we may be irresistibly attracted or repelled by a notation. We easily forget how much a notation, a form of expression, may mean to us, and that changing it isn't always as easy as it is, say, in mathematics or the sciences. A change of clothes or of names may mean very little, and it may mean a great deal. End quote. Now, the more general moral Wittgenstein seems to draw in this passage is that while a choice of name or a way of talking is, from one perspective, purely a matter of convention, from another perspective, it can have enormous significance, significance that leads us to attach great importance to talking one way or another. The principal point is that we attach so much significance to these ways of talking that we fail to see the questionable commitments involved, commitments that may turn out in closer investigation to be nonsense. In this passage, Wittgenstein's targets are metaphysical views, such as, only my pain is real pain, or this tree doesn't exist when no one sees it, which he compares to the view that, quote, the real Devonshire has just these boundaries and no other ones. Now, such claims, Wittgenstein points out, allow of both what he calls a metaphysical and an empirical construal. Say, understood empirically, the claim that only my pain is real could mean others are just pretending. Understood metaphysically, it loses that everyday sense, but appears to say something much more profound and fails to say anything at all. Much the same could be said of the view that there were two Wittgensteins, or that there's an early and a late. Understood empirically, this amounts to pointing to particular continuities or discontinuities in his way of doing philosophy. Understood metaphysically, it appears to sum up something much more profound, that fundamental difference between the early and the later Wittgenstein, or that essential unity to Wittgenstein's work that has been the subject of so much debate. But here I think the expressions have ceased to do useful work, because their task is no longer to draw our attention to particularities. Instead, they've turned into one of those ideals, functioning like a pair of glasses on our nose, through which we see whatever we look at. I quote, it never occurs to us to take them off. We predicate of the thing what lies in the method of representing it, impressed by the possibility of a comparison, we think we are perceiving a state of affairs of the highest generality. And that, of course, comes from PI 103-4. Okay. Within the world of Wittgenstein interpretation, widespread acceptance of the two Wittgensteins framework set the stage for a couple of debates. First, one with one Wittgenstein interpreters, who see the later philosophy as much similar, more similar to the earlier, and among two Wittgensteins interpreters over when the crucial changes took place. Was there a middle Wittgenstein, a Wittgenstein 1.5, so to speak? Was there a sharp break, or was there no Kehre at all? Trouble for the two Wittgensteins framework begins as soon as one considers the very wide range of views about what the essential difference between the early and the late consists in. And now I want to offer a summary of a representative range, sort of short menu, you might consider, of possible positions about the point at which Wittgenstein's later philosophy emerged. Okay, 9 views in search of a philosopher. 1, Paul Feyerabend, 1955, Review of the Investigations. The late Wittgenstein is already in the Tractatus. It already contains the principal ideas of the investigations, notably a critique of essentialism. Apparent innovations in the later book are largely due to a misleading and problematic style. View number 2, Rush Rhys, preface to the Blue and Brown books. The later Wittgenstein primarily emerges in this material, the 1933-5 writings. However, Rees does note the investigations pays much more attention to the question of why we're tempted to sublime the logic of our language, and that its principal theme, he says, is the relation between logic and language. View 3, Baker and Hacker, four-volume analytic commentary. The later Wittgenstein emerges in the 1930 to two manuscripts and the big typescript. According to them, Wittgenstein's philosophy, later, has two components. The later philosophy begins in October 29 with a rejection of phenomenalism for physicalism, but only in 1936 are the full implications, the primacy of language games in constituting word-world relations, fully realized. View number 5, Stephen Hilmy. The later Wittgenstein emerges in the 1920s. The material from the early 30s, setting out the mature view, is the result of working out ideas already developed prior to 1929. The Hilmy reading is similar to Baker and Hacker's, but assimilates language games and calculi in creating an early, later Wittgenstein. View number 6, Eckermann Savigny, in his commentary, the later Wittgenstein is first found in the investigations itself. Now, Monsevigny maintains questions of genesis and composition are not really relevant to the reader's task, so dating becomes unimportant. So presumably the later Wittgenstein emerges in the final composition of the book, and he takes it to be an argument for two interrelated theses. There are both semantic and psychological notions are to be analyzed in terms of patterns of social behavior. View number 7, Cora Diamond, the realistic spirit. Later Wittgenstein is already to be found in the Tractatus. All philosophical propositions, both those of the Tractatus and the investigations, nonsense. The aim of Wittgenstein's philosophy, early and late, is to get us to see this. Here, Diamond denies the standard assumption that there is an easy contrast to be drawn between an early metaphysical Wittgenstein and a later anti-metaphysical. View number 8, the one you'll find in my book on Wittgenstein on Mind and Language. I propose that the later Wittgenstein emerges around about 1934-6. There, the view is that there was a transitional view, which I call theoretical holism, on which language is composed of rule-governed systems, and in the mid-1930s, Wittgenstein moves to a view on which language begins from the primacy of action and practice. And finally, just to round out the full menu, view number 9, Alois Pichler has argued recently that the rejection of the goal of a book in favor of an album and the emergence of a characteristic logic style is to be found around 1936, with a Pyrenean skepticism about all philosophy, including Wittgenstein's own positive ideas in the early 30s. Okay, so once we consider this range of views, the view that there's a clear distinction immediately becomes a bit more complicated. Now, this question of doxography is closely connected with equally vexed disagreements about the nature of later philosophy. While there is widespread agreement about the overall character of Wittgenstein's main targets in the investigations, the details are notoriously elusive. It's generally agreed that the book is an attack on pernicious philosophical pictures, say the Augustinian picture of language in the opening sections, or the idea that real names must refer to simple objects, or the idea that there can be a private language. But here I think is where the disagreements are most vexed. Where does such criticism get us? Perhaps the most important disagreement here is between what I'll call left Wittgensteinians, who take the investigations to be putting an end to philosophy, and right Wittgensteinians, who read the investigations as ending traditional philosophy in order to do philosophy better. According to leading right Wittgensteinians, and here I would list, say, Peter Hacker, the early Baker, David Peirce, Jakob Hintzeker, or Eckermann Savigny, Wittgenstein does replace mistaken views with a quite specific positive position of his own, though of course there's disagreement about what it is. But broadly speaking, I take it the view is that Wittgenstein offers us some form of post-Kantian philosophy, one which turns on the logic of our ordinary language rather than the logic of mind. A logico-linguistic critique of past philosophy that makes a new philosophy within the limits of language possible. Now, the philosophical investigations itself certainly invites, asks for, one might say, a positive philosophical reading. And anyone reading the source materials will find plenty of arguments for positive philosophical positions. And perhaps for this reason, so far, most Nachlass readers have been right Wittgensteinians. Now, the result of this critique of previous philosophical views about the nature and limits of language is supposed to be a clear view, an Übersicht, of the grammar of our ordinary language. Now, just how the investigations provides a clear view of grammar or criteria or language is very controversial. But the point is usually taken to be that we can give a definite refutation of traditional forms of epistemological skepticism. Challenges to our knowledge of the external world or our minds are shown to be wrong, say because criteria and internal relations are supposed to prove that the matters in question are known to be true. On the other hand, left Wittgensteinians, and here I would list as examples Cora Diamond, Jim Conant, Marie McGinn, see Wittgenstein's contribution as therapeutic. One might say a Pyrenean critique of all philosophy, including Wittgenstein's own. Now, according to left Wittgensteinians, Wittgenstein aims to get us to give up all positive philosophical views, not to provide a new and improved philosophy. Wittgenstein, in some sense here, is giving us a form of Pyrenean skepticism. A skepticism aimed not at everyday life, but at philosophy itself. Left-wing Wittgensteinians maintain Wittgenstein was in the business of putting an end to philosophy and teaching us to get by without a right Wittgensteinian replacement. And Hanno Glock has provocatively called this the no-position. Now, this whole controversy over method is in turn closely connected with the question of what Wittgenstein means when he says past philosophy is nonsense. On the right Wittgensteinian reading, Wittgenstein has some kind of a theory of sense based on, say, criteria or grammar or forms of life, and this is then used to show that what philosophers say doesn't accord with that theory. On a left Wittgensteinian reading, there is no such theory of sense to be found in his writing, and to say that philosophy is nonsense is just to say that it falls apart when we try to make sense of it. Now, my own view, for what it's worth, is that both sides in this debate over Wittgenstein and the end of philosophy have tended to become overly dogmatic. They have misread a book, The Investigations, with a profoundly dialogical character, mistaking voices in the dialogue for the voice of the author. The Investigations is best understood as inviting the reader to engage in a philosophical dialogue, a dialogue ultimately about whether philosophy is possible, about the impossibility and the necessity of doing philosophy, rather than advocating either a straightforward right or left answer. So the result, I believe, is to emerge out of our involvement in the dialogue of the philosophical investigations, into our being tempted into or attracted towards philosophical theories, and are coming to see that they don't work out in particular cases, rather than as a straightforward message that is being conveyed by the authorial voice. Well, now I want to try and reflect on the situation as I've described it. Why do we encounter so many Wittgensteins in the secondary literature? Why are we irresistibly attracted or repelled by notations such as the early Wittgenstein, the later Wittgenstein, or the new Wittgenstein? To make better sense of the development of Wittgenstein's thought, we need to attend closely to two complementary aspects of his writing that are rarely brought into focus at once. One, the extensive process of revision and selection that led to the composition of the Investigations, and two, the quite particular style of Wittgenstein's most polished work. Those who are seriously interested in the style of the Investigations rarely pay much attention to the Nachlass, and Nachlass scholars rarely take style seriously. I should probably say there are some leading exceptions to these broad generalizations in the audience. Surprisingly, many of Wittgenstein's most careful readers regard his style as ornamental, effective or distracting, but not integral to the philosophical point. Most discussion of the style of the Investigations has been by authors with no knowledge of or interest in close study of the Nachlass. In fact, it's mostly been by what one might call left Wittgensteinian writers marginal to the analytic mainstream. And here one would have to mention at least Bausma, Cabell, and Rorty. Nachlass-based work on Wittgenstein's post-Tractatus writing has usually turned on what Hanno Glock calls, in a charming phrase, passage hunting in the Nachlass jungle, on the question of when and where certain views or arguments in the Investigations first occur in his writing. Now, while focus on the origins of the Investigations has led to a new attention to the development of Wittgenstein's later writing, it also meant that even the most thorough readers usually regard the 1929-35 writings as source material for the Investigations, rather than reading in its own right as a statement of Wittgenstein's philosophy at the time, Something I think that the Archontrollte was trying to warn us about last night and may well be warning us against in more detail later on today. Further, I think these readers have rarely paid enough attention to the way in which Wittgenstein wrote, and the way in which that style is integral to his way of doing philosophy. So his writing has usually been approached so far by enough class scholars as containing arguments that could fairly easily be unproblematically extracted from the particular context. Thus one can hunt for those passages in the jungle, bring them out of their rich native fauna and flora, put them on exhibit, and see them in the zoo of Wittgenstein arguments much more clearly. Now, an interesting exception to the rule that the first wave of Nachlass scholars didn't give enough attention to style is Christoph Neri's work on the 1929-32 manuscripts. He has observed that nearly all of the distinctive features of Wittgenstein's later style, the use of dialogue, imaginary examples, numerous questions, and so forth, are already to be found in the 1930 manuscripts. But in a way, I believe the Neri work too proves the rule I've been offering, in that he too, I think, adopts in his research at that point what one might call the checklist approach. It's enough for him that these features, say dialogue questions, occur without much attention to their use and context. Now, the standard view about the development of Wittgenstein's thought that's emerged from what I'd call the first generation of Nachlass scholars holds that the philosophy of the later Wittgenstein can already be found in his writings from the early 30s. Which include, as is well known by now, both a critique of the Tractatus and the emergence of a host of characteristically late Wittgensteinian concerns. Now, this reading gains considerable support from the fact that a substantial fraction of the investigations was actually drafted during the first half of the early 1930s. So, if one looks back from the investigation towards its sources and assigns a date to passages by looking for the first substantially similar draft of that material, something encouraged, I think, by the Helsinki research, there is no doubt that one can date the later philosophy to the early 1930s. However, if Wittgenstein had died in 1930, or even 1933, it is hard to imagine, and I think that's an understatement, that subsequent readers would have found the standard views about the later Wittgenstein in those manuscripts. Wittgenstein's 1929-30 writing contains not only the beginnings of his critique of the Tractatus, but also a deeply Tractarian epistemology and philosophy of mind and mathematics, a very strange brew of solipsism, phenomenalism, physicalism, and behaviorism. The big typescript, assembled around 1932-3 on the basis of writing in the previous few years, is perhaps closer to the investigations than the Tractatus, but nevertheless very different. Now, a particularly important, what one might call, test case for the view that Wittgenstein's later philosophy emerged in the early 30s is the so-called chapter on philosophy in the investigations, sections 89 to 133, much of which is based on the real philosophy chapter of the big typescript, much of which was first drafted in 1930 to 31. Here I quote Baker and Hacker. The manuscript sources of sections 89 to 133 date primarily from two periods, 1930 to 1 and 37. Still quoting, it is noteworthy that the general conception of philosophy that dominates Wittgenstein's later work emerged so early, namely in 1930 to 1. And they then say in parentheses that the 37 reflections are largely concerned with criticizing the idealization of logic and language in the Tractatus, and that's primarily source material for 89 to 108. Similarly, Stephen Hilmey also sees the emergence of Wittgenstein's later conception of philosophy in much the same light. I quote, one needs only a quick glance at the contents of the relevant passages in the investigations to see that they are key expressions of Wittgenstein's later approach to philosophy. The vast majority of these remarks were originally written between 1930 and 32. Notice how this methodology I'm describing is laid out by Hilmey here. Quote, the big typescript served as a significant source of remarks expressing his new approach to philosophy. Remarks included unaltered in his masterwork. Indeed, Hilmer's views go even further than Baker and Hacker in that he thinks that Wittgenstein went back to philosophy in 1929, I quote, because he had adopted in broad outline his later approach to philosophy. Only if this were the case could his 32 to 32 manuscripts have served as such a major source of his general remarks on the nature of philosophy for his later work. 1933 to 6, or for that matter 1930 to 32, was not so much a time of transformation in his overall approach to philosophy as a protracted period of applying his approach to the full range of issues, an activity which, in fact, preoccupied Wittgenstein for the last 20 years of his life. Okay, now, in view of this extensive use of material from the big typescript in the investigations, the conclusion is easily generalized. Not only Wittgenstein's mature conception of philosophy, but also his characteristic approach to central issues had already been formulated in the early 30s. And here we have a convenient summary from Hanno Gluck. Quote, the big typescript marks the end of the transition period since it already contains this mature conception of meaning, intentionality, and philosophy. Given this result, it must follow that any subsequent changes are more a matter of merely stylistic refinement, working out implications that had already been adopted. Again, according to Hanno Gluck, the change, say, from Eine philosophische Betrachtung to the first draft of the investigations marks a turning point more in style and manner of presentation than in method or substance. And note here how the contrast between style on the one hand is relatively unimportant, and matters of method or substance on the other is simply taken for granted. However, the claim summed up by Hilmi that the vast majority of investigations 87 to 133 was originally written between 1930 and 2 is misleading at best. I mean, it's just not even right as a piece of straightforward textual exegesis. Less than half of those remarks contain any material drafted between 1930 and 32. Counting on a line-by-line basis, well over two-thirds of the swatch of text originates in material from 1936 or later. Now, it is true that some of the best-known expressions of Wittgenstein's later method were drafted in the early 30s. And I can cite chapter and verse if you want. But I would say that the remarks that do date from the early 30s are mostly concerned with repudiating an a prioristic dogmatic methodology and hardly amount to a blueprint for the later philosophy. In the case of open-ended and programmatic remarks about method, which is really what we're talking about here, what we're pointing to are verbal continuities, hardly what has been claimed by the people I've been citing to be continuities in doctrine. Now, it's right, I think, by Hilmi and others to dismiss an extreme contextualism in which the meaning of any particular instance of a remark of Wittgenstein's is completely determined by the overall context. But surely the force of Wittgenstein's remarks, which he repeats in both the big typescript and the investigations, and here I quote, double quotes you might say from both periods, what we do is to bring words back from the metaphysical to their everyday use, or the work of the philosopher consists in assembling reminders for a particular purpose, quotations like that, I think, gain their significance from the way in which that task is carried out in the respective texts. In other words, I think Wittgenstein's method in the investigations, and here I would scare quote that, can't be separated from his treatment of specific cases, and that did change enormously after 1932. Now, it's also true that Wittgenstein did assemble a huge collection of passages from the big typescript from in 1937 and 8, and he did use them as a resource in constructing the philosophical investigations. Now, it's also true that there's much more material from the big typescript to be found in the investigations than, say, the Brown Book. So if you just count words and assign it priority on the basis of words used from text, then you might say the big typescript is a more important source. But I don't think it follows that the big typescript as a whole could possibly be regarded as representative of what Wittgenstein was doing when he wrote the investigations. At the most, what Hacker and Hilmi have established is that there are certain themes connecting the two, not that there is a position set out in both. The existence of manuscript sources from an early date doesn't by itself show that the later writing expresses the same view. Even within the big typescript, you have to concentrate on a very limited number of issues and pay no attention to strikingly behavioristic, verificationist, and idealist and solipsist themes. For instance, you can quote from the big typescript, if I use language to get another to understand me, this must be a matter of understanding in the behavioristic sense, or the truth in idealism is that the sense of a proposition consists entirely in its verification. Now, rather than regarding these as statements of Wittgenstein's later philosophy, I would argue that they show the big typescript is far less unified than these readings would have us believe. Wittgenstein's views between 1929 and 35 changed rapidly. Any simple periodization fails to do justice to the fluidity of his views during these years. I think we can distinguish a phenomenalistic or solipsistic phase during the early months of 1929, which Wittgenstein already began to give up in late 29. In my work on the development of Wittgenstein's philosophy and Wittgenstein on Mind and Language, I argue that Wittgenstein's philosophy in the early 30s is best understood as what I call logical holism, a view clearly distinct from both logical atomism and the Tractatus, and a practical holist view that one finds in his later work. In particular, what you have in that period is the consequence of Wittgenstein's recognizing that there are logical relations between propositions that can't be captured by crude functional logic, that there are grammatical relations specific to certain subject matters. The priority of practice is a central theme in the development of the later philosophy. But the first half of the investigations is, for the most part, very careful to avoid advocating any such thesis, a temptation Wittgenstein really does succumb to elsewhere. Passage-hunting methodology makes it only too easy to read the more doctrinaire assertions that are part of Wittgenstein's writing from the 30s and 40s as statements of convictions that undergird the investigations. And I would take the Baker and Hackett commentary, with its construal of grammar and internal relations, to be the gold standard for such doctrinaire readings. If one approaches the investigations as the most carefully revised expression of Wittgenstein's writing as a whole, one will not do justice to the quite particular character of the investigations. The principal change, I believe, in the composition of the Prüfassung, or the early investigations, out of the previous source material, is not the honing and refining of arguments, but primarily a matter of making it more dialogical and less didactic. Here I found Alois Pichler's research on the origins of the investigations extraordinarily helpful. However, this final twist in understanding the development of the investigations shouldn't be seen as just another variant on the two Wittgenstein story, or as committing us to holding that other changes in Wittgenstein's thought between the Tractatus and the investigations are less important. I would say that the decisive rejection of many aspects of Wittgenstein's pre-1929 work in the period up to 1931, such as the talk of calculi and grammar, the rejection of phenomenology, criticism of dogmatism, or what I would like to call a move from logical atomism to theoretical holism, is also a significant transition. So is a major shift that I see taking place during the later 30s towards practical holism, a shift that has a lot to do with the growing acknowledgement of the importance of the priority of practice over rules. Now, what is at issue here is the character and methods of the investigations, or perhaps, to be more careful, the most carefully composed parts of part one of the investigations, say roughly sections 1 to 425. Now, what I'd like to suggest is a more fruitful approach here is to give further thought about the relationship between part one of the investigations and those writings to which it is often assimilated by those most careful students of the Nachlass. The work from 1929 to 45 that led up to the composition of part one, and the work done after it was completed. Okay, so here are two areas of research that I think we would do well to think about harder than we have done so far. First, the relationship of part one of the investigations to the previous writings, and especially to source materials. To what extent is the change from the writings of the 33 to 35 period to the investigations a matter of a change in setting out a view that remains relatively constant? And to what extent does it amount to a fundamental change in outlook? I myself am more in sympathy with the latter view, but I think it's actually quite hard to read the last third of part one of the investigations as achieving a balance between left Wittgensteinian skepticism about philosophy and right Wittgensteinian dogmatism, as does the first 425 sections of the investigations. The dialogue towards the end of part one of the investigations is not as evenly balanced and has a more right Wittgensteinian tenor than the first two-thirds. His editors tell us he'd hoped to rewrite it. And I think there are excellent textual grounds for thinking this. If you look at the sources, as one now can do much more easily with the Schulte edition, you can see that a great deal of sections 425 to 693 predates 1936 in its composition, and it was incorporated rather rapidly around the time of the end of the Second World War, and was never as carefully and thoroughly revised as the first part. So I would suggest that even within part one, one can actually see a more dogmatic, more sort of right Wittgensteinian view in the end of part one than one can find, I think, in the early part of part one. Okay, question two. The relationship of part one of the investigations to Wittgenstein's subsequent writings. I don't think the writings on philosophy of psychology from, say, 45 to 48, or for that matter, the so-called part two of the investigations, fit all that easily with a left Wittgensteinian reading either. To a considerable extent, they actually seem closer to what I would call a practical holist or a grammatical reading. But of course, there are places where Wittgenstein is quite explicitly therapeutic and critical in this later writing, too. So, one possibility would be the view that Wittgenstein had really worked things out later on and was actually moving to, I would say, more sort of doctrinaire or sort of criterial view of philosophy. Another view is that he was, as usual, struggling with these things, and only if he had actually written something he was satisfied with could one say that he had changed his mind from the much more balanced and dialogical position that one finds in the opening of part one. Now, I think it's misleading to regard Wittgenstein's thinking as undergoing a once-and-for-all turn, a point after which he achieved the insights of the later, or as some would prefer, his entire philosophy. Rather, Wittgenstein's philosophy is a struggle with conflicting impulses, and it's that struggle that gives his thought its peculiar vitality and importance, one that is fully achieved only in his most carefully revised writings. It is this quite particular and exceptional process of composition that makes part one of the investigations, and perhaps the first 400 sections of part one of the investigations, all the more important. If we give up our reliance on simple stories of misery and glory, we're still left with all the hard questions. And here I want to paraphrase Wittgenstein once more. Someone might object against me. I quote, you take the easy way out. You talk about all sorts of language games, but have nowhere said what makes them Wittgenstein's philosophy. So you let yourself off the very part of the investigation that once gave yourself the most headache, the part about the general form of Wittgenstein's philosophy. In reply, I would quote Wittgenstein's own answer to a very similar question. Don't say, there must be something common, but look and see whether there is anything common to all. If you look at them, you will not see something that is common to all, but similarities, relationship, and a whole series of them at that. To repeat, don't think, but look. And the result of this examination is, we see a complicated network of similarities, overlapping, and crisscrossing. Sometimes overall similarities, sometimes similarities of detail.